their offer to pay for its replacement was met with silence. A gymnasium had been built for the original barracks, but it was set between the inner wire and the surrounding walls. Out of bounds. It would have been ideal as a recreation space for the men, particularly as the weather got worse. And so, when not in line or sitting in their packed rooms, prisoners wandered back and forth in the crowded Spielplatz like penned cattle. Bathing facilities were a horse trough that had hot water only twice a week, and the men had to wash in full view of the rest of the camp. A shower house had been built on the senior officer's request, but Niemeyer decided to use it to shelter his Alsatian guard dogs instead. He even posted a sign outside that read, "When a more suitable place in the camp can be found for the dogs, officers may have baths on Tuesdays and Fridays." Theft was pervasive. The Landsturms, or landworms, as the British called the typically older militiamen, oversaw the parcel room. It was bad enough that in inspecting items, they destroyed with shameless glee cakes, bread, meat, and other food sent to the prisoners. But they also stole what they pleased, especially cigarettes and soap. Letters from home, often describing what had been sent, were misplaced. At the canteen, Feldwebel Wellmann was equally criminal. Goods were supposed to be sold at cost, but Wellmann charged triple the prices of other camps on everything from coffee, wine, butter, firewood, eyeglasses, pencils, razors, notepads, watches, and toilet paper. The prisoners were certain that he shared most of the profit with Niemeyer, who by camp order number 13 fixed all canteen prices. Their commandant also extorted charges on every prisoner for such necessities as food, hot water, and fuel for the kitchens. Some figured Niemeyer was clearing the kingly sum of 30,000 marks a month in profit. There was no outlet to appeal their legion of grievances. Niemeyer refused to meet with Wyndham or other senior officers, nor would they have had much luck with him if he had. As far as Niemeyer was concerned, his countrymen were the ones suffering because of the British and their allies. Across Germany, food prices had shot up, and people were hawking heirlooms, furniture, and clothing to feed their families. Soup kitchens operated in most cities. Meatless Tuesdays and ersatz products, wheat flour extended with powdered hay, butter made with curdled milk, sugar, and food coloring, were the order of the day. Soaps had vanished from shelves, and tobacco was a luxury, most often mixed with beech leaves. People surrendered their savings for war loans, and their copper chandeliers, bronze bells, steam pipes, and even brass doorknobs to be melted down for the war machine. As well as turning a blind eye to outright theft, Niemeyer set the tone of abuse at the camp, and reveled in it. He paraded about the campgrounds and barracks throughout the day, hands stuffed in his greatcoat, chewing on the big black cigar that was a fixture at the corner of his mouth. His voice could change from a dolorous coo at one moment, "I guess you know, my dear sir," to a tyrannical roar in the next, "You must not speak to me. I am the commandant." He spat on the barracks floors, in front of the British officers. He ordered rooms emptied by bayonet point and conducted searches that left beds and lockers in shambles. For no reason other than a sour mood, he sent men to solitary or closed the parcel room. After only a short time, Gray witnessed how Niemeyer's rule and the non-stop pinpricks that came with it left the men feeling rattled and helpless. The abuses were far less severe than those Gray had documented in the secret report he had managed to keep hidden since his escape from Krefeld, but they were abuses nonetheless. One officer at Holzminden wrote to his mother, "Time drags slowly on here, much the same day after day. It is extraordinary how restless one gets after a while. You feel that you must be doing something, yet cannot settle down to anything." Some had lost a great deal of weight. Others were listless. A few were spiraling into madness. With winter coming, and very little fuel to heat their rooms, their lives were certain to grow darker. Internment in Holland seemed a fool's promise, and the war showed little sign of ending soon. Each would have to find a way to survive the place they now called Helmenden, or the Black Hole of Germany. Gray knew that he would survive by escaping. He did not yet know how, but he was confident that with the camp packed with a master's guild of breakout artists, many of whom he called his friends, an opportunity would surely arise. In late October, Kennard and several other officers made their break from Holzminden, starting through the removable panel in Block A. Locals in the area surrounding the camp were on the alert for any strangers. And like others before him, Kennard ran into trouble attempting to cross the river Weser, whose width and fast current made for a perilous swim. He was soon caught, returned, and sentenced to solitary. He was one of the last to use the Block A hatch. After yet another intensive search, the guards found it at last, and a whole new series of security measures was put in place. The barricades in Block A were reinforced with iron sheets. Permit passes were instituted for the main gate and elsewhere. Windows were nailed shut. Barbed wire fences were raised. The censoring of letters and inspections of parcels intensified. The barracks were scoured for contraband, and the number of guards increased. Niemeyer dedicated every effort to ensuring that the black mark on his record, owing to earlier escapes, would be erased by the prevention of future ones. The Holzminden inmates were clearly jailbreakers of the First Order, and he intended not only to make the prison impervious to their schemes, but to crush their spirits in the process. "You see, gentlemen," he announced to the whole camp, "you cannot get out now. I should not try. It will be bad for your health." Part 3. The Tunnel. Chapter 12. Shorty Cahoon, all 6.5 feet of him, wanted to dig a tunnel. He saw no other way out. Although the tunnels they had built at other camps had fallen shy of success, he remained confident that such a plan could be pulled off at Holzminden. Desperation steals the spine that way. Scouting the camp for the best place to start a sap was a simple exercise in eliminating options. Given the number of Germans inhabiting Block A, Cahoon crossed this location off the list straight away. The cookhouses and woodshed in the Spielplatz were easy to access, but too public, and too far away from the surrounding camp wall, so those were eliminated as well. That left Block B. But where? Most of the cellar space underneath the officers' section contained detention cells, and guards watched over the corridor night and day. The cellars under the orderly quarters in Block B, which were used to store wood, tins, bread, potatoes, and other goods, emerged as a possibility. Although guards did patrol this area, they did so infrequently. Further in the cellars' favor was their location adjacent to Holzminden's eastern wall. A tunnel would need only stretch some 15 yards to reach beyond the camp wall, out into an unguarded field. Now, Cahoon needed to get inside the cellars to see whether a passage could be dug there. Access through the iron-reinforced barricades that separated the officers' quarters from those of the orderlies in Block B was impossible. He considered knocking a hole in one of the ground-floor rooms on the barracks' eastern side to reach the eastern stairs, but any thorough inspection would likely uncover that. Officers and orderlies each had their own entrance to the barracks. The officers was in the west wing, the orderlies in the east. Officers were forbidden to use the orderlies' entrance, and a guard posted 12 yards opposite the door took note of all comers and goers. But there was no oversight of orderlies entering the officers' section to carry out their daily duties, and it was here that Cahoon found his plan. Obtain an orderly's spare uniform. Don the uniform inside the officers' quarters. Walk out the door and onto the Spielplatz. Turn left and walk the 50-yard length of Block B to the orderly entrance. Enter the building without arousing the suspicion of the posted guard. Cahoon recruited his friend, William Baxter Ellis, a young RFC pilot, to join him on the reconnaissance. A pair of orderlies they trusted provided uniforms, and also managed to craft a duplicate key for the cellar door. On November 1, 1917, when most of the German guards were inside the Kommandantur during lunch hour, the two officers made their bid. Even though Cahoon, tall and gangly, could hardly be considered inconspicuous, nobody paid him, or Ellis, any mind as, disguised as orderlies, they crossed the yard and entered the eastern wing. The door closed behind them. Inside, they found that the layout was a mirror image of their own wing. They could either take the short flight of concrete stairs to their left, up to the ground floor, or the 10 steps to their right, down to the cellar. They went down. Before they arrived at the locked cellar door, something caught their attention. The Germans had completely walled off the space underneath the flight of steps that led up to the ground floor. A quick rap on the 6-inch wood planks revealed the space behind the wall to be hollow. They guessed the wall had been erected to prevent anyone from hiding there, or lying in wait to jump an unsuspecting guard. The men agreed that the space might well present the perfect opportunity. It gave them access to the cellar floor and walls. It was out of sight, and it was out of the way of the normal foot traffic of the guards. Starting a tunnel in one of the open cellars would have risked discovery, whether by a guard coming into the storeroom or appearing in the corridor as they exited the cellar through the door. If they could construct a trap door in the planks, then, Cahoon was sure, they had a very good chance of keeping their activities secret. Will you join our tunnel effort? That was the question on Cahoon and Ellis's lips. The answer was an easy yes for Mossy, Rogers, and the rest of the Pinktoes at Holzminden. They had attempted such an escape at every single camp in which they'd been held. Gray was not a sure thing. Despite his sapper education and British Indian Army experience, he had avoided tunnels in the past. Cahoon must have thought this time might be different. He was right. Gray was in. He had good reasons to join this scheme. First, the access point in the cellar was absolutely ingenious. Second, the ground under Holzminden was far more stable than at Schwarmstedt or Stroen. Third, the tunnel had a much shorter distance to run than its predecessors. Fourth, if they emerged unseen from its exit at night, they would have sufficient time to gain distance from the camp before they were reported missing at morning roll call. They would need this kind of head start to cross the Weser before daylight. As Gray knew too well, breaking out was only part of the battle. Before getting too far ahead of themselves, they needed to determine that a trap door could be made in the wooden panel. If such a hatch, or the mechanism to open it, was in the slightest way visible, the Germans were sure to find it. Holzminden's guards were on high alert for the next escape attempt. At Gütersloh, Krefeld, and Schwarmstedt, Rogers and Mossy had made an art of building sliding steps and hinged walls. In comparison to some of those projects, this new tunnel entrance would be a breeze. First, they would need woodworking tools, and for these they would need a carpenter. Since their imprisonment, the men involved in the scheme had become practiced thieves. They smashed in a door in Block B, where they were housed, making sure to knock it off its frame and mangle the lock, something only an experienced tradesman could fix. A carpenter arrived later that day, his box of tools at his side. A guard accompanied him to watch over his work, repairing what the Holzminden staff thought amounted to a random act of destruction. Next, the diversion. Cahoon and his co-conspirators, including Gray, started an argument with the guard, some minor disgruntlement. There was a lot of shouting, and a few of the officers staged a scuffle. While the carpenter stopped work to observe the fray, One of the officers slipped behind him and nicked several tools from his satchel, including a fine-toothed, thin-bladed saw, ideal for precisely cutting wood. After the melee, the men waited to see if there would be a search for the missing tools. What they suspected and hoped was that the carpenter and the guard responsible for him would not admit to having been duped by the officers. Their suspicion proved well-founded. The next day, disguised in borrowed yellow-banded tunics, Mossy and Rogers ventured through the eastern entrance of Block B, accompanied by an orderly who had agreed to keep lookout. A quick examination of the walled partition showed that the best place to create a door was near the bottom of the steps. There, the planks were longest. At the top of the last plank, there was a small opening from some badly fitting boards where a slide bolt could be hidden. Reaching it would be a tight fit for even the most slender of fingers, but possible. Mossy and Rogers were quick to the task. To better see what they were doing, they unscrewed the whole V-shaped panel from its placement. An inspection of the chamber behind confirmed exactly what Cahoon had hoped. It was a space with access to the floor, as well as the main, load-bearing walls on the eastern and southern sides of the building, and it was almost tall enough for a man to stand up in. Measuring 5 yards long and 4 yards wide, it was also big enough to pack the excavated soil and rubble for a 15-yard tunnel. This eliminated the need to smuggle the material out for dumping. They cut a 3-plank door out of the partition wall and then reattached it with 2 hinges on the back. Such was their precision that there was almost no visible seam between the 18-inch-wide door and the wall. They also mounted a bolt on the door, its latch just within reach behind the wall. After sweeping the sawdust into their secret chamber, they replaced the whole panel and secured the bolt. So snug was the fit, they could barely spot the door themselves. Tools hidden under their tunics, they walked back up the steps and out into the Spielplatz. With a secure entryway in place, the tunnelers wasted no time, launching immediately into the digging. Cahoon and Ellis had the honor of going first. Hacking at the concrete cellar floor was fruitless, and they had no idea how deep the concrete had been laid. The main walls, though thick, were at least a known quantity. They started on the southern wall, just a few feet under the landing. First, they removed the bricks. Then they dug into the concrete with a chisel. After a few inches, they hit some reinforced iron rods. Even the sharpest of hacksaws would be challenged by the iron. They took the obstacle in their stride. What they needed was sulfuric acid to burn through the iron like a flame into paper. However, they could not exactly buy a vial of sulfuric acid in the canteen, and obtaining some via a coded message to friends or family in England would take too long, even if they managed to avoid its interception. They knew they needed outside help. They wanted to keep their cabal small, 12 officers at most, to ensure the tunnel stayed secret, as well as to limit the number of individuals going in and out of the building, the better to avoid detection. The success of their plan relied on orderlies, who were able to move around the camp unrestricted and obtain any items the officers needed. Willing accomplices were found. Among them, Ernest Collinson, George McAllister, G. E. Raisy, F. E. Sidwell, E. G. Harrison, L. W. Saunders, and Dick Cash. Of not being part of the actual escape, an orderly joked, "It's a case of women and kids first, sir." One of the orderlies just so happened to know a civilian workman at Holzminden who had access to sulfuric acid. A bribe of 50 marks was enough to secure the workman's assistance. Like the other orderlies at Holzminden, roughly 130 in number, Private Dick Cash of the 19th Battalion, Australian Imperial Force, had no plans to escape. If he did make a run for it and was caught, the best he could hope for was to be sent to the hell of a POW labor camp. Holzminden was far from a pleasure palace, but his chances of starving or being worked to death there were slim, compared with the salt mines or the like, where he'd surely end up, given his rank. When an officer was caught in the act of escape, he was typically returned to camp and thrown into solitary. Both custom and international conventions govern the treatment of officers, who fared better as POWs than members of the rank and file. The British-born Cash might have avoided service on the Western Front altogether. When war had broken out, he was 37 years old, a father of three, and owner of a small grocery store and photography business in Thirlmere, Australia, a railway town southwest of Sydney, where his family had emigrated many years before. Just a bit over 5 feet 2 inches tall, he was thick-set, with startling blue eyes and light brown hair. He had first tried to sign up to fight in September 1914, wanting to do his bit, but the Australian Imperial Force refused him because of his age and small stature. The war was far from being over that Christmas, as many had predicted it would be, and 18 months after his first attempt, Cash put in another application. Standards for enlistment having been lowered by this time, he was accepted. After training and the long voyage to Europe, he arrived on the front in March 1917. His battalion saw its share of heavy fighting. On May 3rd, the men made an early morning assault on the strategic German stronghold at Bullecourt. The Australians faced withering heavy machine gun fire in their approach to the enemy lines. During the attack, Cash was shot in the chest. The bullet punctured his left lung, but he continued ahead. A series of mortars threw him first skyward, then sideways. Shrapnel pierced his back, and many of his teeth were knocked out before he landed in a shell hole, boots first. The ongoing barrage then filled up the hole around him until all but his head was underground. There he remained for almost 30 hours, trying to squirm his way free, before he was taken prisoner. Field surgery and a torturous 300-mile ride into Germany had followed. Cash managed to survive the maggot-infested squalor and rough attention accorded many wounded Allied prisoners, and spent the next few months bedridden at a hospital in Hamelin, a town within the 10th Army District. He wrote numerous letters to the Red Cross and his family, not sure if any were reaching their addressee. "I have no money and no clothes, and nothing to smoke," he expressed in one note. "But, with a little help, I should be able to get my strength back." By September, he had recovered enough to be sent to Schwarmstedt to work as an orderly. Then he was moved to Holzminden. Cash had begun to receive a steady stream of care parcels and letters from home, but the news that came with them brought only heartache. His baby daughter Myrtle had died, as had his mother and one of his brothers. His wife Sissy struggled to care for the family and keep their businesses afloat. Compared with the horrors he had faced on the front and in hospital, Cash knew that he could abide the lesser evil of Holzminden for as long as he had to in order to get back to her. He lived with the other orderlies, many of whom were also recovering wounded, in a barricaded-off section of Block B, farthest from the main gate. 20 men sleeping in double-deck bunks inhabited the same size room that fit 12 officers. They crawled out of their cold beds before the officers awakened, and dressed in gray-blue tunics, trousers, and caps sewn with bands of yellow cloth down the sides. Their prison number was stamped in red on the front of their shirts, and the large letters KG, Kriegsgefangener, prisoner of war, on the back. At 7 a.m., Cash began his day serving as the nanny, or batman, for 5 officers. While most of them were still asleep in their beds, he steeped a pot of tea and set out their teacups. He collected their uniforms, caps and boots, and polished and cleaned them before the wake-up call. Then he ate his own breakfast and showed up for morning roll call. After that, he returned to his officers' rooms to make their beds, empty their ashtrays, and tidy up their quarters. Then he and a band of other orderlies swept the corridors and staircases. Twice weekly, they changed the bedsheets and beat the dust out of rugs, Once lunch was over, the Germans typically assigned the orderlies to some menial task around the camp, such as bundling up paper or hauling firewood. Then they went back to straighten their orphan officers' rooms, make afternoon tea, and help serve meals. Most of the work was fairly light, albeit monotonous, and they rotated rooms so they did not have to suffer any particularly needy officer for long. As one orderly wrote, "Taking the officers by and large, they were a pleasant and easygoing crowd, perhaps inclined to be a little thoughtless." For those Tartars, Cash and the others could always exact a trivial retribution, a broken teacup, undercooked food, to signal that they would only be pushed so far. None of this service seemed odd to Cash, his fellow common rank soldiers, or the officers they served. Although they were all prisoners, so traditional was the separation between them that not even Niemeyer, who abused them all at every opportunity, ventured to make the officers fend entirely for themselves. European society had a rigid class system in its own right, and the military was another beast altogether. As one historian noted, there was a wide, indeed gaping distinction between officers and men, emphasized not merely by separate quarters and messes and different uniforms and weapons, but by different accents and dictions and syntaxes and allusions. In London, an officer was forbidden to carry a parcel or ride a bus, and even in mufti, dark suit, white collar, bowler, stock, he looked identifiably different from the men. When a 10-minute signal was called on the march, officers invariably fell out to the left side of the road, other ranks to the right. However, they knew that they were all in this war together. They all faced the cruelties and whims of the camp commandant, the dreary repetition of days, the interminable lines, the thefts, the meager amounts of food, and most important of all, the absence of freedom. A number of orderlies who had been transferred to Holzminden had helped officers at other camps escape, providing them with uniforms or acting as lookouts. They would do the same now with the tunnel plan. Cash, with his toothless smile, made clear to the officers his willingness to help. On November 5th, Guy Fawkes Day, Jim Bennett came out into the frozen Spielplatz for evening roll call to find Douglas Lyle Grant, Holzminden's best-fed officer, practicing the goose step right in front of Commandant Niemeyer. Arms swinging, knees high, chin stuck out like he was awaiting a punch, Grant gave it his all. For his comic show of protest, he was let off for 3 days in solitary detention. Something was afoot at Holzminden, and clearly Grant did not like it. That morning, without explanation or forewarning, several of the most senior and outspoken prisoners had been sent away, including Major Wyndham, Lieutenant Colonel Rathborn, and Captain Gray. Throughout the day, and into the next, Holzminden received what one prisoner labeled an eyewash. Officers and orderlies alike were instructed to straighten their rooms and barracks. Whitewash came out by the barrel. The bathhouse was opened for use. Burned-out electrical bulbs were replaced. Windows were opened, and fuel was supplied to heat their rooms. The next day, they discovered the reason. A surprise visit from Dr. Romer, the Dutch inspector. Some of the prisoners had met Romer before, at Stroen and Schwarmstedt, and despite their complaints, nothing had changed for the better. By the generous welcome Commandant Niemeyer offered Romer on his arrival, they guessed that he was on the take and would deliver only a glowing report on the camp to his superiors, which would be passed on to Berlin and London. The men tried to air their grievances over the unjust treatment they'd received at the camp, even in the presence of the camp commandant, but Niemeyer was always ready with an explanation or justification. On the poor quality of the food, this was simply a matter of taste. The men had their private supplies anyway. On charging for boiling water, the men were not compelled to pay this sum. On the exorbitant prices at the canteen, most of the articles were sold at a loss. on the excessive stays in solitary, including those suffered by Kennard and others who had escaped from the attic hatch, the accused needed to be secured before their court-martial. Only after that did the new 14-day punishment limit come into effect. On the lack of recreation space, the men were free to use their sleeping quarters for this purpose. On the long lines to obtain parcels or food tins, the prisoners simply showed a lack of enterprise. On the absence of parole walks, the prisoners had chosen to tear up their cards rather than adhere to the rules. Roemer's visit confirmed there was no recourse to compel Niemeyer to improve conditions. The whole inspection was a charade, and even though Bennett had put on a brave face for his mother on his arrival at Holzminden from Stroen, writing that he was not yet able to form an opinion of the change, he knew from the start that his only option was to break out as soon as he was ready. Every day he rounded the perimeter of the Spielplatz 50 times, clocking up roughly 12 miles in distance to prepare his legs for the journey to the border. As he jogged, ignoring the curious looks of some of his fellow prisoners, he studied the shifts of the guards, the movements in and out of the main gate, the places outside the barracks where he might hide. No matter how hard he searched for a weakness in the camp's security, he found none. He dismissed the possibility of a tunnel, unaware that there was already one in the works because of limited access to the cellars. Ever optimistic that an opportunity would arise, Bennett wanted to be ready. His fitness plan was only the first step. The next was gathering together everything he would need once outside the walls. The number of failed escapes through the hatch proved to him that preparation was key. There were lots of men at Holzminden who had made a run for the border, and Bennett gleaned what he could from them in conversation. He made a mental checklist. A considered plan of the route to be taken, type of country to be met, most suitable spots to hide, how to cross the rivers and canals, food and drink for the journey, best kind of disguise and how to obtain it. Last, and most important, maps and compasses. He intended to obtain his kit through coded messages to his family. Since his imprisonment at Stroen, he had lost many of his supplies, except for his naval uniform, which could easily be converted into a civilian outfit by stripping it of its brass buttons, rings, and badges. Bennett began by sending a letter to his half-brother John in London. He asked him to call in on a photography shop owned by a man named Stanford near Covent Garden. He wanted a shot of the Rolls-Royce he had bought in 1915 to decorate his room, he said. Bennett had never owned such a car, nor did he have the funds for one. Stanford's was actually a well-known London travel and map shop. He sent his next letter to his mother, thanking her for the recent parcel of food and clothes, though he joked, "I have now enough peas to run a shop." Rice and packets of Quaker oats would be better, he wrote, before mentioning, in an almost offhand manner, "By the way, I hear from Mrs. J. Fitzgerald they have moved and now live at 39 Royal Avenue, Chelsea. I should like for you to call and give her my kind regards." He concluded, "Keeping in very good health and spirits, and looking forward to seeing you in the ensuing year, I am your loving son." Mrs. J. Fitzgerald was a thinly veiled code word for his former escape partner, Roy J. Fitzgerald, who had made the home run to England from Stroen. Roy would know exactly what Bennett needed for his own attempt. Then he waited, continued his daily walks, and searched for a way out as the weather turned bitter cold. In late November, after 6 weeks in isolation at Clausthal, suffering almost daily harangues from Heinrich Niemeyer, Cecil Blaine received the news that he was to be transferred to another camp. At the gate, Niemeyer gave him a smug look and said, "Good luck. Give my love to Piccadilly, Hyde Park, South Kensington, and all the rest of those places. Goodbye, Mr. Blaine. Goodbye." Blaine promised himself that the commandant would pay the consequences if he ever tread on English soil, or if he came across him anywhere else, for that matter. Guards escorted Blaine by train to Stroen. There he was reunited with David Gray for the first time since their separation at Osnabrück, almost a year before. They had many stories to tell about their individual attempts to reach Holland, many bitter lessons to share. Blaine inspected his new camp for a way out, and discovered, as Gray had since his arrival from Holzminden several weeks before, that the place was a rabbit warren of tunnels and hiding places. However, any possible openings the Germans had not discovered and blocked had a long line of prisoners waiting to use them. Neither Blaine nor Gray would have the opportunity. Stroen was being closed, and its occupants scattered among several other camps in the 10th Army District. Blaine was going to Neunkirchen, a mining and industrial town in the crosshairs of British bombers, and Gray quickly back to Helmenden. Chapter 13. The head of the Prisoner of War Department, Lord Newton, found himself at the cluttered nexus of foreign, domestic, and military affairs. Based at Downing Street, his job was to assist British POWs in Germany and oversee the treatment of enemy prisoners held in Britain. The fate of more than 100,000 men depended on his ability to maneuver his government, as well as deal effectively with the impetuous decisions of Kaiser Wilhelm II. Throughout late 1917, Newton's desk was littered with reports about the Holzminden camp. To start, he had the latest inspection report from the Dutch representative. According to Roemer, who had visited Holzminden in November, there was little cause for concern. The officers' complaints were minor in nature and could be obviated with a little mutual goodwill. After chronicling the need for modest improvements in the exercise grounds and sleeping arrangements, Roemer concluded, "The general impression that I was able to gather was of a favorable nature. All the officers looked well and appeared to be in good spirits. The commandant, although maintaining strict discipline, appeared desirous of doing everything possible to render the life of the prisoners as bearable as circumstances could permit." Lord Newton doubted the official report. He had received troubling secret intelligence about Roemer from contacts in the Foreign Office. Informants suspected that he had compromising connections with German high officials, and, according to Roemer's former colleagues, he was professionally incapable, amenable to bribery, and a pathological liar. Further, he had issued similarly positive reports of other camps, controlled by Hainisch, that were contradicted by a binder full of interviews from escaped prisoners. Similar testimonies were now coming into London about Holzminden, one by an RFC captain who smuggled a coded letter out of the camp. He recounted a string of brutalities, including the time when four guards cleared his room to make way for newly arrived prisoners. The first officer was seized by the throat and shaken. The second was struck with a rifle, and the third chased down the passage, his pursuer jabbing at him with his bayonet. Other prisoners, who had been sent away from Holzminden, only to escape from their next camp to Holland, recounted much the same. One asserted that Hainisch ran his camps with organized malevolence. Another, that Holzminden was an inferno. Something needed to be done, Lord Newton knew, but he had few good options on the table. In the past, he had tried the diplomatic route, submitting letters of complaint. These had little effect. He had also sat down with the Germans and negotiated to improve conditions, most recently in the summer of 1917. Both parties had agreed to reduce punishment lengths and to begin exchanging some prisoners. But Newton's trust in this process had been eroded by reports indicating the Germans were continuing indefinite detentions, and had only just begun returning POWs, and in limited numbers at that. The other tool available to Lord Newton was instituting reprisals against German POWs until things got better for the British. But this only provoked countermeasures by the enemy, a tit-for-tat special treatment that worsened conditions for all. When it came to Holzminden, Lord Newton and his staff decided that the best way forward was to push for another inspector to visit the camp and to demand that Hainisch be immediately removed from command. before they could move forward, however, the British War Office and the Foreign Office needed to weigh in on the matter. Reports and handwritten memos were exchanged between the various departments, but any action, low though its chance of success may have been, proceeded at the glacial pace of bureaucracy. And so the men at Holzminden remained there, at the mercy of faithless agreements, without protection, notwithstanding the best intentions of those charged to provide it. Like most veteran prisoners, Gray knew that help from the outside was not coming any time soon. Returned to Holzminden from Stroen in mid-December, he immediately resumed the tunneling work started by Colquhoun and Ellis. On one of his first days back, Gray met with two officers at 11 a.m. in room 24, on the ground floor of Block B's officers' quarters. From under a false bottom in a wooden box, the men withdrew several sets of uniforms worn by prison orderlies. After donning this garb, they smudged their faces with dirt, the better to look like common rank prisoners who had just finished a work detail. Then they waited to get the call from their team of lookouts. One orderly stood watch at the entrance to his quarters, making sure there were no guards lingering in the stairwell or cellars. Once he counted the last guard to leave for his midday meal, he walked onto the Spielplatz and scratched the top of his head. Colquhoun, who was loitering outside the office entrance, ostensibly reading a book, received the signal. Advancing to the door, he glanced toward the Kommandantur to ensure no guards were on their way to Block B, then hurried inside and straight to room 24. "All clear," he said. With that, Gray and the two other officers put on their black caps banded in yellow, stuffed some struts of wood under their shirts, and emerged from Block B. Other officers and their cabal kept a keen eye on the guard stationed in No Man's Land, 12 yards opposite the orderly's door. If there was any indication the guard sensed something amiss, the men were to mount a distraction. The tunnelers figured this was unlikely. Roughly 2 platoons of 30 guards each patrolled the campgrounds. They rotated beats and hourly shifts frequently to maintain sharpness. By circumstance, and to the benefit of the tunnelers, this routine resulted in the same guard occupying the same spot only once every other week. With 550 officers and over 100 orderlies, the chances of a guard detecting an unfamiliar face entering the quarters were slim. Gray and his digging partners arrived at the orderly's door without trouble. On closing it behind them, they waited for another lookout to confirm that all was clear. Only then did the three move down the steps. At the panel wall, they were met by another orderly. He reached into the narrow hole at the top of the secret door and unlatched the bolt. The 18-inch-wide door swung open, and the three officers stepped sideways into the dark chamber behind. The orderly closed and bolted the door behind them. He would return in 2.5 hours, so the officers could get back to their quarters, change, and make the afternoon roll call. Thin lines of light between the planks were all that illuminated the space, until Gray struck his lighter and the shadows of the three men danced upon the low walls. After unburdening themselves of the wooden struts they had smuggled inside their shirts, they lit a few lamps. These were made from empty shaving cream tins, with holes punched through the top, from which extended wicks made from twisted cloth soaked in alcohol. They could now see well enough to change out of the orderly uniforms into the plain work outfits they would wear while digging. For Gray, these damp, streaked clothes used by all the tunnelers were anathema, as even in captivity he strove to keep himself spotless and his shirt and pants pressed to within an inch of their lives. The work clothes smelled too, as did the whole chamber, a mix of mud, rot, sweat, dead mice, and stale air. Stifling his disgust, Gray put on the clothing. In the time he'd been at Stroen, Colquhoun and the Pink Toes had burned through the iron rods in the southern foundation wall, just up from the cellar floor, by pouring sulfuric acid on them from cups made from molded clay. From there, they had started the tunnel proper, Using spoons, kitchen knives, and the legs of their iron bedsteads, they created an oval sap, almost 1.5 feet in diameter, and supported by the wood struts. Initially, they extended the tunnel 3 yards straight out from underneath the orderly's entrance. The depth was minimal, and the men could hear the voices of the guards and prisoners walking above. Then they veered the sap sharply to the left, eastward, toward the camp wall. To increase its depth, they dug at a 45-degree downward slope for roughly 6 yards before leveling out. The ground, a compacted blend of yellow clay, dirt, and loose rock, was tough to burrow through, but they still managed to cut about a foot a day. By the time Gray returned to Holzminden, the tunnel was approaching the eastern wall. Their excavated debris nearly filled the entire space underneath the stairs. They had made remarkable progress, and now it was his turn to do his bit, no matter his reluctance to enter the dark hole. Gray knelt down by the tunnel entrance, pushing into the chasm the shallow wash basin the men used to collect the dirt they tunneled through. Then he followed it, lamp in hand. The earth crowded around him like a tomb. Since being released after a month-long stay in solitary, Will Harvey had bunked with several of the Pinktos in a small attic-floor room. The place was a funhouse of compartments hidden behind wall panels, sliding windowsills, and loose plank floors, all to hide the contraband Mossy, Rogers, and a few other Pinktos had collected for their latest bid for freedom. Although he had been informed about their newest tunnel, Harvey did not push to be a part of it. His failed escape, then the long punishment that followed, had put him off further breakout attempts. As winter deepened at Holzminden, his mood only darkened further. There was never enough food. What they did have was almost exclusively tinned, and some of the men were suffering from malnutrition. There was scarce fuel for the stoves, leaving the barracks frigid. Many had already stripped their rooms of any available wood to burn. Bedboards, locker doors, even whole pieces of furniture. Niemeyer continued to harass them at every turn. He shut down access to the bathhouse and the parcel room on a whim. He promised the new senior British officer that he would reopen negotiations with respect to parole walks, only to rescind the promise soon afterward. He gave his consent to concerts and theatricals, then retracted it just before a scheduled performance. Then there were his rages, rising from out of nowhere. On the evening of December 14th, Private Turner, an orderly, was running across the Spielplatz to the latrine when Niemeyer stopped him in the yard. He asked the young private where he was headed in such a hurry.
"The latrine, sir," Turner said.
"You may shit yourself," Niemeyer screamed. "Or you may shit in your bloody hand. You may shit where you like, but you are not going to the latrine tonight."
In response to such treatment, some of the prisoners fought back. Some engaged in small acts of resistance. A Scottish officer marched out to the bathing trough in the Spielplatz every day, no matter the lack of hot water or how much snow was on the ground, and washed himself while bellowing, "The Scots are a hardy race!" Others crafted an effigy and dangled it from an attic floor window, a noose around its neck. Niemeyer went berserk, firing at the dummy as the prisoners bobbed it up and down. The glass shattered in several windows before the prank ended. Another officer dumped a sack of potatoes from a window as Niemeyer passed underneath. The greatest resistance of all would be to escape. Two prisoners tried to hide in the bottom of the trash cart that was emptied outside the camp each day, but were unable to endure the malodorous heap long enough to make their break. Another madcap plan was put together by RFC pilot Robert Capon and Royal Newfoundland Regiment Lieutenant Andrew Clouston. Using dining room shelves, the men constructed a chute, and Capon, formerly an astronomer at the Greenwich Observatory, engineered a seat running on tracks. Shortly after Niemeyer shamed Private Turner simply for trying to answer nature's call, the pair executed their plan,
On a foggy night, they extended their cobbled-together chute out the first-floor window of Block B's officer wing. The chute stretched far enough to sit on the barbed wire that topped the camp's northern wall. After settling into the sliding seat, with their kit bags secure in front of them, Clouston and Capon were off. They made it halfway down the chute before the seat jumped its track. They pitched off the side and landed almost at the feet of a guard. As well as sending the two officers to the jug, solitary, Niemeyer instituted a collective punishment for the entire camp. Both barracks were shut for 24 hours, and the dining rooms locked. The men could neither exercise nor cook their meals. Every time Niemeyer foiled a plot, he would smugly gloat. "Gentlemen, you have taught me a lesson," he boasted, after stopping a trio of prisoners attempting to escape, one of whom was shot in the wrist by a guard. "I shall not forget it. You need not trouble any more. Good morning." Harvey weathered Niemeyer's punishments and buffoonery, but because he was uninterested in revenge or escape, he had little to occupy his time. The moldiness of prison was settling over him again. He rarely took walks in the yard anymore. He did not have the will to shave. He did not write. Then, one December evening, he lay down on his bed and discovered that his friend Mossy had sketched in chalk on his ceiling some ducks frolicking in a pond. They reminded Harvey of the ducks in the pond beside the Redlands, his Gloucestershire home. For a long time, by the flickering light of a lamp, he stared at the ducks. And then, unable to contain himself, he started to laugh, uproariously. His roommates hurled boots, sponges, and other sundries at him to be quiet, but Harvey kept laughing. "What the devil is the matter?" they asked. "I was just thinking," he said. "What an extraordinarily funny thing is a duck." After the wake-up call the next morning, he sat down and began a new poem, the first in a long while. It was all thanks to Mossy's unexpected gift. "From troubles of the world, I turn to ducks. Beautiful comical things, sleeping or curled, their heads beneath white wings, by water cool, or finding curious things to eat in various mucks, beneath the pool, tails uppermost or waddling, sailor-like on the shores of ponds or paddling left, right, with fan-like feet, which are for steady oars, when they, white galleys, float, each bird a boat, rippling at will the sweet, wide waterway." At Christmas, Cahoon announced that the tunnel now ran beyond the wall and would soon be finished. They should all finish preparing their escape kits and be ready in the new year. There were great celebrations throughout camp for the holidays. The men sang carols, handed out homemade cards, raised money for the British Red Cross, staged a pantomime of Sleeping Beauty, and ate whatever feasts they could muster. Despite Niemeyer's ban on the sale of wine, Douglas Lyle Grant threw a grand affair, supplied with a cellar's worth of bottles that he joked cost more than a night out at London's swanky Carlton Hotel. Such was their revelry, clapping hands, stomping feet, howling to the heavens, that at one point they wondered if their party was causing a disturbance in town. In another room, one of the tunnelers put together a lavish menu using most of his stores of food, signaling his optimism of their soon-to-be-found freedom. Using shaving mirrors for serving plates and blankets for tablecloths, the men had a fine time. The following morning, Boxing Day, Niemeyer announced that 20 officers, most of them prisoners since 1914, were being sent off by train to Holland. After half a year of promises, internment transfers had come to the 10th Army District. A few slated to leave were part of the tunneling party. Since the sap was almost complete, they did not feel the need to recruit replacements and thereby risk revealing its existence. The men shared farewells at the gate, and many other old-timers hoped they would be next. But into this cascade of goodwill and good news came a terrible surprise from Niemeyer in the form of a new security measure. Without explanation, The commandant ordered guards to take up permanent stations outside the stone walls of Holzminden. When the guards took their positions, the tunnelers' hearts sank. One guard was standing opposite the east postern gate, at almost the exact location Cahoon had set for the tunnel exit. Had someone informed on their operation? Could they still manage to escape from that spot if they waited for a shift rotation? Would the guard stations be temporary? There was no intensive search, so it was likely their secret was safe. But the men decided that the shift rotation would not allow them enough time to break through to the surface and get away unseen. They watched day after day to see if the guards abandoned their new posts. They remained. The consequence was profound. To extend the tunnel beyond this new guard's line of sight, they would have to proceed another 45 yards past the barren flat field that bordered Holzminden until they reached some rows of rye, which would provide the necessary cover only come July. It was January now. Without such cover, the tunnelers knew they risked a bullet on emerging at the exit. They all remembered what had happened to Morit at Schwarmstedt. At a foot a day of digging, this distance calculated to almost 20 weeks of work. Such an amount of time would make keeping the tunnel secret almost impossible. One errant word, one slip-up caught by a vigilant guard, and all would be lost. Then there was the sap itself. A 15-yard tunnel was a manageable affair, but at 60 yards, cave-ins would be more likely, as would obstructions that demanded a change in direction. More important, the time spent underground would become even more insufferable. The farther they dug, the longer it would take, and the more exhausting it would be, to wriggle through to the end of the hole. Such long periods in such a cramped space, so far from a safe retreat, would be both physical and mental torture. Finally, a sap of such distance would run short of fresh air. Some in the team lost heart, but not the once reluctant Gray, one of its senior leaders. He was determined to continue. The officers would need more men. Gray turned to Caspar Kennard. Chapter 14. Caspar Kennard wriggled on his belly through the tunnel, dragging a sack of tools and the circular basin behind him. He used his forearms and the toes of his boots to move himself through the tight, low burrow. Cascades of loosened dirt fell down into his collar. The dirt stung his eyes and grit lined his mouth. None of this discomfort compared to the rising swell of fear that seized him. He hated confined spaces, and even though every instinct told him to break loose from this burrow, to retreat, he continued ahead. His life had shifted in such strange and unimaginable ways over the past 2 years, from ranching in the open ranges of the Argentinian Pampas to flying in the wide blue skies over England and France to trading one solitary detention cell for another. Not one of those cells could compare to the dreary darkness of this sap. But since recruitment to the secret effort early in the new year, Kennard had managed his claustrophobia. There was no better way out, especially given the chance to get a head start before a manhunt was launched, than through a tunnel like this. His own impetuous run from Holzminden had proved this fact. On reaching the tunnel face, Kennard lodged his tin can lamp into the dirt by his side and drew out the gauge created by the pink toes to maintain a consistently sized hole. Too small, they would not be able to crawl through without a collapse. Too big, they would waste time and excavate too much dirt that would have to be hauled out and stored away. The gauge was of basic construction. Two thin boards, one 18 inches long, the other 14 inches, secured by a pivot at the center. Kennard swung the boards open until they formed a cross and placed them in front of him, the shorter board vertical and the longer horizontal. The ends marked the boundaries of their roughly oval tunnel. Once the gauge was fixed, He began to dig, using a chisel and trowel to scrape, stab, and pry loose the earth ahead of him. Progress was almost imperceptible,